Thank you very much for inviting me. Thanks also to the organizers for putting me first. This talk is about two pieces of joint work, one with Terra Home, and the other is ongoing work with Megumi Harada and Gregory Landwehr. Now, several of you have already seen the first couple of slides in the previous talk I gave, but after that it's going to be a bit different. This goes back to Newton. Newton, in his physics, did a lot of numerical work, and one of the problems he ran in naturally is when you have a bunch of observation points which lie in the graph of some putative function, then you'd like to approximate that function with a polynomial function. Or in other ways, you'd like to fit a polynomial to go exactly through those data points. And of course, it's very well known how to do that. It's just a Lagrange interpolation formula that we teach to our freshmen. But Newton was more than 100 years before Lagrange, and he put it a little bit differently, and it's actually worthwhile to understand what he said. Instead of struggling through the antique notation, let me just translate for you in modern notation what he did. The first thing to do, I think, is perfectly obvious. If you have those data points, well, then of course those data points give you secants to the curve going through those data points. And the first thing to do is, of course, compute the slopes of those secants. It gives you a bunch of numbers. And then what you proceed to do is you compute second order slopes and third order slopes and so forth. And from all those numbers, you concoct an interpolating polynomial. And it goes as follows. So we just start with an arbitrary function, real function on the real line. And then we have the first order divided difference. That's now a function of two variables, fx1 minus fx2, divided by x1 minus x2. Yeah? That's the slope of a secant. The first order divided difference operators. And we can iterate that operation to get a second order divided difference, which is now a function of three variables, and so forth. And of course, those functions are not defined everywhere, only where the variables are distinct. So now here's Newton's recipe. Suppose you're given your observation points, say times and values of your function at those times. Then, you proceed to compute the divided differences between all those data points. And it gives you, if you had n plus 1 data points, it gives you n divided differences. And then you compute divided differences among those, and so forth. And you get a triangle of numbers. You can do this n times, and then it stops. And you get this triangle of numbers, and the interpolating polynomial you can read off from the upper edge of that triangle as follows. Your function, f of x, is equal to a zeroth order term. That's the value at the first observation point, plus a first order term, a linear term, x minus a1 times the first slope, and then there's a quadratic term, x minus a1 minus times x minus a2 times a second order slope, this divided difference, and so forth. And then this is the interpolating polynomial, and this is valid for absolutely any function as long as the a's are distinct. But of course, this cannot be true exactly. F is any function, and the right-hand side is a polynomial, so there has to be a correction, and that's the remainder term, which itself looks like a polynomial of order n plus 1, but now there's a coefficient, n plus first order divided difference, and now there's an x dependence there, and now it's an exact inequality. It's very straightforward. Combinatorial identity. as I said, the A's have to be distinct, but if your F is sufficiently differentiable, then you can let the A's approximate a common value, say A, and then the formula just turns into Taylor's formula with the integral remainder term. I said the divided difference operators turn a one variable function into a two variable, three variable function, and so forth. But of course, you can also view them as acting on, commonly acting on the functions of n variables. For example, the first order divided difference operator, I can just view it as operating on functions of two variables by taking f of x1, x2, and then switching the variables, and then taking this divided difference operator. So really what you're doing here is you're taking the function, and then you're reflecting the two variables. Now we're following Costin's precept of seeing roots everywhere. You're reflecting the function in what is in reality the first simple root of the Lie group, the unitary group, and then we're dividing by that root, x1 minus x2. So we can view all those operators as endomorphisms of the ring of n variable functions, or in particular as the ring of polynomials in n variables with integer coefficients. There's a fairly obvious variant of these operators, sometimes called the isobaric divided differences. I'm not sure about the history of those. Really what you do is you divide the ordinary divided difference operator not to f of x, but to x times f of x. So that's obvious enough. I'm calling the variables t because I'm going to do substitution in a minute. So the first order isobaric divided difference operator just does this to your function. You get a t1 and a t2 in front. And now I'm going to formally invert my variable and rewrite it in this way. And then what you see here is you have an exponential analog of your first simple root. I do this formal exponential substitution, and then it turns into this expression where you have e to minus alpha 1. And so what in effect what you get is operations on the ring of polynomials in those t variables, but you invert all of them. So now we're looking at Laurent polynomials. And what does the operation do to a Laurent polynomial? Well, the ith, this formula is correct only for I is 1. The first order divided difference operator, what it does is it takes your Laurent polynomial, it switches these first two variables, and then you multiply by this factor, e to the minus alpha, this factor here. And then you divide by 1 minus e to the 1 minus alpha 1. Now, besides those roots, there's something else going on here. Those polynomial rings and Laurent polynomial rings have an alternative interpretation as well. We look again at the unitary group, and we look at its standard maximal torus, the diagonal unitary matrices. And then the polynomial ring is really nothing but the equivariant, torus equivariant cohomology of a point. The Laurent polynomial ring is nothing but the equivariant K-theory of that same point. I'll review what those things mean. But once you've given topological interpretation to those rings, the question arises, do those divided difference operators themselves have a topological interpretation as well? And the answer is yes. This was done by two former students of Costin's, Bressler and Evans, in the early 90s. And I will review their work. And what we're going to show something in addition is that you don't just have these operators acting on a point. You can, in fact, substitute for the point any topological space on which your group acts. And we're going to get these divided difference operators as acting on a generalized equivariant cohomology theory. And we have several applications with that in mind. The one I'll discuss today is what Atiya called the splitting principle. Very roughly speaking, the G is UN, or some arbitrary compact Lie group with maximal torus T. The G equivariant cohomology, or K theory, roughly speaking, embeds into its T equivariant counterpart, as roughly speaking, as a direct summand. And roughly speaking, the G equivariant cohomology, or K theory, is the wild group invariance inside the T equivariant counterpart. But that is only true if you ignore torsion. And it turns out that these divided difference operators will help you to understand these the situation a bit better. It'll explain to you how to calculate the G equivariant cohomology in terms of the T equivariant cohomology. So that's one of the purposes. So let me just quickly run through the basics of equivariant cohomology theory. Well, it's just the Eilenberg-Steenrod axioms with a group thrown in. It doesn't even have to be a Lie group. So we're looking at pairs of topological spaces, X and the subspace A, and there's some group acting continuously, and the subspace is supposed to be preserved under the group. And we look at maps between pairs of such spaces. And the maps, of course, also are supposed to preserve the action, the equivariant maps. And then the axioms are as follows. A generalized equivariant cohomology theory assigns, is a contravariant functor on this category, it assigns to any pair of spaces a graded abelian group in such a way that, well, the assignment doesn't depend on the, is invariant on the homotopic. Two maps are homotopic. The maps between the equivariant cohomology are going to be the same maps. And then there's an excision property and the long exact sequence property. I'm not going to write those out. Those are just basic things that one does in algebraic topology. And the coefficients of my equivariant cohomology theory are what you get if you apply your functor to the pair consisting of a point, comma, the empty set. I don't think so. I'd have to think about that. Now, usually we ask a little more of our cohomology theory. We ask that it should be multiplicative. So the cohomology of a space will turn out to be, in fact, not just a graded group, but a graded ring. In particular, the coefficient system itself is a ring, and the equivariant cohomology of any space will be an algebra over the coefficient ring. The second additional piece of information that we want is an orientation. Orientation is a quality that allows you, so to speak, to integrate cohomology classes. And in particular, if you have a map from one space X to another space Y, it allows you to take a cohomology class on X and integrate it over the fibers of your map, and then you get a cohomology class downstairs. In other words, you have a push-forward homomorphism. Orientation gives you wrong-way homomorphisms. And the last thing you ask is, well, is it reasonable comportment under change of groups? If you have a homomorphism from a group G to a group H, and you have a space X on which H acts, well, then naturally G will act on X as well via that homomorphism phi. So you can take equivariant cohomology of X in both senses. And you want the group homomorphism to induce a morphism between the equivariant cohomology. Well, some examples of theories that have all those properties are the Borel ordinary equivariant cohomology, Atiya's equivariant K theory, And then there's equivariant complex cobordism and various elliptic cohomologies and so on. Let me just explain ordinary cohomology and K-theory. The ingredient for ordinary, for the Borel equivariant cohomology is, well, a universal space for the group G, a contractible space on which the group G acts freely, and then you can form the quotient of that space by the action of G, and that gives you what's called the classifying space of G, and it is a classifying space for principal bundles with structure group G, whence the name, and those two ingredients let you do the following construction invented by Borel. You can take any space in which G acts and fatten it up with this contractible space and look at the diagonal action of G on that object, and that gives you something which is called the homotopy quotient of X by G, and it comes naturally with a map to EG mod G, is by forgetting the X factor. So there's a natural map to the classifying space, which is a fiber bundle map and which has as generic fiber the space X. And second, you can forget the factor EG, and then you get a map to the ordinary quotient, the orbit space X mod G. And the Borel equivariant cohomology of X is by definition just the ordinary cohomology of that homotopy quotient with integer coefficients. The coefficient system of this theory, well, you apply the theory to a point, then the homotopy quotient of a point is the classifying space, so you get the cohomology of the classifying space, and that's the ring of where the universal characteristic classes live. Whenever you have a bundle over a space with structure group G, characteristic classes of that bundle will be pullbacks of classes from this universal ring. Some quick examples. If your group is a torus, what is the coefficient system? It is the product of circles, n circles, un, across itself n times. Well, then the coefficient system is just the polynomial ring that we were looking at in the beginning over the integers in n variables. The variables have degree 2, so this is a commutative ring. If you look at the unitary group itself, then the coefficient system is a subring of the polynomial ring, namely the ring in the universal Chern classes, the ring in the symmetric polynomials, the ring of symmetric polynomials, which is generated by the elementary symmetric polynomials. Is an example of a very easy space on which the circle acts. It's the sphere spinning around its axis. The circle equivariant cohomology of that space is a polynomial ring in two variables, modulo this relation, x squared equals y squared. The x is the contribution from the classifying space, the coefficient system. The y is the contribution coming from the ordinary cohomology, so to speak. This is an example of a so-called equivariantly formal space. You can recover the ordinary cohomology from the equivariant cohomology by specializing some of your variables. In fact, by setting x equal to 0. And then you get the ring, the ordinary cohomology. Sorry, I should have written a y here. It's a polynomial ring in y modulo the relation y squared. That's Borel, equivariant cohomology. Equivariant K-theory, or ATIA, is in some ways simpler than that. It's based on vector bundles, Let vec g of x denote the set of all, the category or the semigroup of all vector bundles with complex vector bundles equipped with an action of the group g in such a way that the projection, so with the linear action of g on the fibers. Well, then in the ordinary way, you can form the Grothendieck group of that semigroup, and that's called the equivariant K-theory. Well, that's the degree zero piece of equivariant K-theory. You have equivariant K-theory in all degrees n, for n any integer. To get the equivariant K-theory in other degrees, well, basically what you do is you take your x and you cross with a Euclidean space, and then you take the K0 equivariant K-theory of that. Except that wouldn't give you anything different because of homotopy invariance. But what you have to do instead is, I don't want to go into details here, what you have to do is you have to look at K classes on this product, which are, well, which don't stray away too far from X, so to speak, which are compactly, vertically, compactly supported on this product. Well, anyway, we have this K theory, which you can roughly understand as the Grothendieck group of the equivariant vector bundles. And there's this famous relationship, the Bott periodicity, that if you shift your index by 2, you recover the same group. And the coefficient ring, if you plug in x is equal to a point, well, k0, you're just looking at vector bundles over a point with a group action. So that's this virtual representations. And the ring of that is called the representation ring. And it's also, you can view it as a ring of the ring generated by characters of irreducible representations, so a subring of the algebra of class functions on your group. And the K theory of a point is zero in all dimensions. Here's some quick examples. Again, the coefficient system for a torus, a product of n circles, representation is the representation ring of that torus, is that Laurent polynomial ring. The polynomials in the axes and the inverses. The coefficient system for the unitary group is, well, the invariance again under the permutation group inside this polynomial ring. What is that ring? Well, that's the ring in the elementary symmetric polynomials, and you invert the last one. And so that's kind of a mix between polynomial and Laurent. It's polynomial in the first n minus one, and then there's a little bit of a Laurent ring. You've inverted only the last variable. The equivariant K-theory of the sphere with respect to the circle spinning the sphere around its axis is as follows. It's a Laurent ring in two variables, x and y, and their inverses. And again, with the same relation as in equivariant cohomology of that same space, x squared equals y squared. Now, as Greg and Nagumi showed, this is an example of a class of spaces that are equivariantly formal for K-theory. For this space, you can recover the ordinary K-theory by specializing it, by setting the x variable equal to 1 this time. And then you get the ordinary K-ring of the sphere, which is a polynomial ring in variable y, modulo the relation y squared equals 1. Now let me get back to these divided difference operators. So from now on, I'm going to let my equivariant cohomology theory be either the Borel or equivariant cohomology or the Atiyah equivariant K theory. And my group, I'm going to take any compact connected Lie group. and I'm going to choose a maximal torus, and I'm going to denote by J the inclusion of the maximal torus. I'm going to look at any space on which the big group acts. And little h of G is either of these theories. Then, as I said at the beginning, you have this pullback map from G covariant to T covariant theory. But these theories are oriented theories, so we also have a push-forward map going from T covariant to G covariant theory. Let me just remind you of the definition of this push-forward map, at least for K theory. So we look at the class here. Well, that's represented by a T covariant vector bundle on our G space, X. Now, whenever you have a T space, you can enlarge it to a G space in a very obvious way. You can take your X, multiply it, cross it with G, the Cartesian product with G, and divide by the diagonal action of T. Then you get the G extension of your space. In fact, because in this context, our X already is a G space, this X tilde is just a product of X with the homogeneous space, G mod T. So it just it's a trivial fiber bundle over the space X with fiber that homogeneous space. But you can do the same trick with your vector bundle E over X. I can take the total space of E, cross it with G, and divide by the diagonal action of T, and that will then be a G equivariant vector bundle over this X tilde. Yeah? So now I have this vector bundle E tilde, and this X tilde, I'm going to regard it in the sense of a TR as a family of smooth manifolds. Well, a trivial family in this case. The fiber of the family is this G mod T, the flag manifold of T, and the parameter space is the topological space X. And this E tilde I'm going to regard as a family of smooth vector bundles parameterized by that base space X. And then you can take the equivariant family index of that family. The fiber of the space has a complex structure. You look at the Dolbeau-Dirac operator on that space, and you choose a fiber-wise smooth Hermitian connection on this E tilde, and you couple it with the Dolbeau-Dirac operator, and you take the index of that. And as shown by Atiyah and Singer, that gives you, well, point by point, gives you a virtual vector space on the parameter space, but globally it's actually a difference between two vector bundles, so it's a well-defined class in K-theory. And that's our push forward. Yeah? So that's what's called holomorphic induction in representation theory. And there's a similar operation in ordinary cohomology. Sorry, there were some mistakes on this slide. If you do this operation on the trivial one-dimensional line bundle, well, then you're just looking at the Dolbeau-Dirac index of the flag manifold with coefficients in the trivial one-dimensional line bundle. But that's just the arithmetic genus of the flag manifold, which is well known to be equal to 1. So if you do this operation, first pull back 1, you get 1 on the flag manifold, and you push forward, you get this element 1 in K theory. And what you get very easily from that is that if you first pull back and then push forward again, you get the identity in K theory. And what that is telling you is that the G equivariant K theory of any space is a direct summand of the T equivariant K theory. That's always true. This breaks down rather badly in ordinary cohomology because, well, what happens in ordinary cohomology if you do this, if you pull back the constant function 1 along a map, it's still the constant function 1, and then you push forward again, well, you're integrating over fibers, but simply for degree reasons, that integral is always going to be 0. So this composition is always the zero map in cohomology. And indeed, it's usually false that the G equivariant cohomology is a direct sum end of the T-Guibern cohomology. False even if X is a point. Although it's true if you ignore torsion. Okay, now what are these divided difference operators that I promised you? Well, that's what you get if you perform this composition in the opposite direction. First you push forward from the T-Guibern theory to the G-Guibern theory, and then you pull up again. Yeah? So you get endomorphism of your T-Guibern theory. You can do a similar thing for any root in the root system of your group. Let alpha be any root of your group with respect to the given maximal torus. Look at a root as being a homomorphism from the torus into the circle. Well, the kernel of the homomorphism is a codimension 1 subgroup of the torus, which is either one or two components. And I look at its centralizer, which is well known to be always a connected subgroup of G, of semi-simple rank 1. And of course it contains that maximal torus T. And so I have an inclusion, which I'll call J alpha. And I can do the same push-pull construction with respect to this homomorphism, this inclusion of groups. So from the T-Guibern K theory, I push forward to the G alpha E-Guibern K theory, and I pull back again, and I get an operation which I call delta of alpha. That makes sense for any root in the root system. So I get this family of additive endomorphisms of T-Guibern cohomology parameterized by the root system. And here are some of the properties. They have a mix of naturality properties. First, they're natural with respect to pullbacks. If you have a map between spaces, F from X to Y, and it's equivariant, G equivariant, then it will commute with these delta alphas. The same thing will be true with respect to push-forward homomorphisms. So the delta alphas are bivariant. Okay. If you perform the operation twice, well, then it's the following formula. The square of the operation is the operation applied to the constant, the unit, 1, times the operation itself. It's always 0 in ordinary cohomology, but you get delta alpha back in K-theory. So the delta alphas are projection operators in K-theory, but they are nilpotent in ordinary cohomology. The third property is that you can express the reflections. Of course, we're looking at the T-Guibern cohomology of a G-space, and there will be an action of the Weyl group on that group. And we can describe that action in terms of these operators, delta alpha, as follows. In ordinary cohomology, the action of the reflection in the root alpha is the identity operator minus multiplication by the root alpha times the operator delta alpha. And a slightly more complicated formula in K-theory. The fourth property is, well, these divided difference operators, they're not exactly differential operators, so they don't satisfy Leibniz, but they satisfy some modified Leibniz rule. If you apply them to a product, but here's the rule. The first term looks like the ordinary Leibniz rule, but in the second term you have to reflect the first factor and then apply the operator to the second element, and then there's another correction here. And the last property, it's a braid relation. It says the following thing. For that you need to fix a basis of your root system. So, set of positive roots, and decompose the longest elements, longest bar group element, in terms of simple reflections. And if you compose all the simple reflections, so the operators correspond to simple reflections in that order, you get this operator delta that we were talking about. What these properties tell us basically is the following. Property 3 tells you two things. It tells you that these operators, delta alpha, sort of refine the Weyl group action. And it also tells you that if you look at the cohomology of a point, that the operator delta alpha are the divided difference operators that I was talking about at the beginning. If you just solve, say, this first equation, if you solve it for delta alpha, then this is just saying that delta alpha is the identity operator minus the reflection as alpha divided by the root alpha. That's a divided difference operator. So that's this first conclusion. The second conclusion is as I said, the divided difference operators refine the action of the Weyl group. They extend the action of the Weyl group to an action of a certain algebra, namely the following algebra. Look at the T-Givern cohomology of a point, and you let act all these operators on it. And these generate a certain ring of endomorphisms of this coefficient system. And you also let act the elements of this coefficient system that act on itself as multiplication operators. Those elements together generate a big algebra D, which is introduced by de Maizière. And that algebra, by the reflection formula, contains all the reflections, and therefore contains all the Weyl group elements. And what we conclude is that for any G space X, the T Givern generalized cohomology is a module for that algebra D. How do you mean topologically? About push-pull, push-forward operations.
If I had a map from X of T to X of T.
Right, okay. So, it turns out that in K-theory, this ring is the entire endomorphism ring. Yeah, so whenever you have an endomorphism of the T-Givern cohomology of a point, which is linear of the G-Givern cohomology, then it will be a composition of these push-pull operators. In ordinary cohomology, that is not exactly true, but it's almost true. So here's an application of this. That's this so-called splitting principle. This algebra of divided difference operators has an ideal, a one-sided ideal. It's a non-commutative ring. It's a ring of operators. Look at all the operators which annihilate the units in the coefficient ring. And then whenever you have a module over that ring, D, say the T Givern cohomology of any space, then you can look at the what I'll call the D invariant elements inside that module. By definition, that means an element is D invariant if it's killed by all the elements in that augmentation ideal. Recall that the de Maizière algebra contains the Weyl group, and this augmentation ideal contains the augmentation ideal of the group ring of the Weyl group. The augmentation ideal of the group ring of the Wahl group is that elements of the form is generated by elements of the form W minus 1. Well, W times 1 is equal to 1. So W minus 1 kills the element 1. Yeah? This ideal contains the augmentation ideal of the group ring. That means that an element that is invariant for these divided difference operators is automatically also Wahl group invariant. And the theorem then is as follows. Well, let's again look at one of our cohomology theories, either Borel or Atiyah, equivariant cohomology theory. Well, I'll just ignore the first statement for now. Roughly speaking, the theorem says that G equivariant cohomology is a direct summand of T equivariant cohomology, but the theorem gives you sort of equations for how the G equivariant cohomology sits inside the T equivariant cohomology. Namely, when is a T equivariant class G equivariant? Well, it's G equivariant if and only if it's annihilated by all the divided difference operators in this augmentation ideal. The theorem is in quotes. First of all, it's in quotes because in ordinary cohomology, it's not literally true. It's true only if you, after inverting a few bad primes, the so-called torsion primes for the group. That's the torsion primes in the equivariant cohomology of a point, yeah, the characteristic ring. In K-theory, it's also not quite a theorem yet because we haven't finished the proof yet, but I'm reasonably confident. Let me just finish by stating the main ingredient of the proof of this theorem. It's a result that in the cohomology version is due to de Mazur, and in the K-theory version is due to Pitti and Steinberg. Recall that the T-equivariant cohomology of a point, just for the for UN, the maximal torus of UN, is just the polynomial ring in n variables. And the G equivariant, the UN equivariant cohomology of a point, is the symmetric polynomials. It's well known, of course, that the symmetric polynomials themselves are a polynomial ring in the elementary symmetric polynomials. What is slightly less well known, but equally important, is that the ring of all polynomials is a free module over the invariant, over the symmetric polynomials. Yeah, the generalization of that fact is that the T equivariant cohomology of a point is a free module over the G equivariant cohomology of a point. And if you take that together with the so-called Morita theorem of module theory, then you get this conclusion. And we have other applications in mind for this, but well, we haven't worked them out yet, so I can't report on that yet. But let me stop here. Thank you.